Good morning. So you've probably heard that meditation is good for you, right? I think that's true. And there are many studies that show a host of physical benefits which result from meditation. I'm going to leave it up to you to explore those positive physical benefits. And instead, I'd like to talk to you about the non-physical benefits. What happens inside the mind of someone who meditates? How does it feel? Why should I do this? So let me start by looking at the physical structure that runs the body, the brain. By some descriptions, we have a three-layered brain. The oldest portion can be referred to as the reptilian brain. It takes care of all the boring, autonomic nervous system stuff like breathing, heartbeat, and temperature regulation. It's only the size of a walnut, and it sits deep inside the center of your head. Wrapped around this lump is a collection of several glands and neural structures that collectively are called the limbic system, or the mammalian brain. This part takes care of emotion and memories associated with emotion. Fight, flight, or freeze responses originate here. Our ability to assign value and make judgments originates here. One could say this is the seat of the ego. These two almost independent sections of our brain share the workload of running the body and together provide what amounts to our operating systems. These two brains are exquisitely connected to our surroundings using very high quality sensors and high bandwidth connections that allow the brain to receive data and respond very, very quickly to what happens outside. An emotional response to an external trigger is measured in milliseconds. An emotional response happens in thousandths of a second. The observation and the ability to run away or lash out, therefore, happens very fast, which is actually good if you want to stay alive in a hostile environment. Our sensors, our eyes, ears, nose, skin, and taste buds, well, they're always on. They're always collecting information about our surroundings. And thanks to the reptilian and mammalian brain, we have the innate ability to process this endless stream of incoming random data and constantly look for patterns, which can trigger a near instantaneous reaction, which will hopefully happen faster than the perceived trouble which is headed our way. If we were vigilant and recognized patterns quickly enough, we didn't become lunch. Instead, we have the chance to become parents. This ability to rapidly assign good and bad values, to judge things as better or worse, this predilection for constant observation, this almost uncanny ability to simultaneously process multiple streams of high volume data is now passed along to your offspring. What the NSA is attempting to do with our phone call is child's play compared to what you can do quite easily. Your ability to tweet while eating breakfast and review email for the morning's meeting, all while talking with your partner about the evening's driving schedule, or soccer practice, band rehearsal, and a food store run, is how these systems express themselves today. And it is nothing new. In fact, it's about as old as we are. As if all that capacity weren't yet enough, we humans have grown a third layer of brain material, which has crammed itself around the mammalian brain. This upside-down, wrinkled, half a cantaloupe is called the neocortex, and it processes all the higher thinking functions, like reason and logic, speech, abstract thought, ethics. This roughly 3-pound dollop of neural tissue is the most complex object we know of. Not only is the neocortex able to pull off the incredible stunt of noticing that it exists, it's also created incredible art, science, incredible culture. It seems to be almost infinite in its ability to adapt and change. But compared to the mammalian brain, it's slow in its processing speed. Perhaps it's because the timing for what the neocortex does is not as life critical as heartbeats or breathing or reacting to the panther in the tree above you. Neocortex response times are about 10 times slower than the mammalian brain and reptilian brain. So put all three brain layers together and you have, well, what you get is the most dangerous animal on the planet. As Edward Wilson describes us, we are a bizarre combination of Stone Age emotions, medieval beliefs, and godlike technology. Given this crazy quilt mashup of old and new, it's no wonder that we perseverate over events that didn't go the way we wanted them to go, or get emotionally hijacked by things we regret the morning after, or drive ourselves crazy with conspiracy theory, or ruin a perfectly good night's sleep by waking up at 3 a.m. remembering that the credit card bill hadn't been paid. So what does this confused processing mean? Why should you care? Well, at a practical level, it means that it's a good idea to put that emotion-packed email in the drafts folder and give your neocortex time to catch up to your ruminating brain. Think a while before you hit send. Given enough time, eventually the neocortex forms thoughts about what's happening, but it's almost in slow motion compared to the lightning-fast response mammalian brain offers. These initial neocortex thoughts trigger secondary thoughts, which eventually become part of an internal dialogue, and given enough time, may reach a conclusion about what your eyes saw or your ears heard a while ago. And in the meantime, the mammalian brain has long since gone back to collecting data for the next observe and judge mission. The bottom line is we are hardwired to feel and react to our feelings literally 10 times faster than we're able to think. This means we are hopelessly and permanently out of sync with ourselves. Amidst all this crazy flopping and thrashing about that is human existence, there has been the occasional teacher, scholar, or philosopher who studied the condition of being human. One of those ancient scholars who turned an observing eye inward was Siddhartha Gautama. Born into a royal family, he grew up lacking nothing. No want went unfilled. He lived in an island of royal opulence surrounded by a sea of human misery, which can still be found today, 2,500 years later in northern India. In time, as Siddhartha grew up, he noticed what was beyond the palace walls his family lived in, and realized that everywhere he looked, he found pain, an endless ocean of human suffering. He recognized that he personally was unable to end this suffering for any more than a few handful of people. This dilemma drove him crazy to the point where he decided he was going to sit down and not get up until he'd either died or solved this problem of universal, apparently unavoidable, seemingly endless suffering. What eventually happened was an insight about human existence. He now understood, one could say, the lights went on. He was enlightened. He understood the nature of things and of suffering in a way he had not previously understood. And the philosophy and way of life that grew from his teachings today we call Buddhism. He struggled with what is real and what comes from the outside versus what is imagined and comes from the inside. And eventually he noticed this fundamental truth called dependent origination. A simple definition of dependent origination might be that everything is defined relative to something else. Everything is related. Or as we UUs would say, that we are all a part of the interdependent web of life. This foundational understanding led Siddhartha Gautama, or as we refer to him today, the Buddha, to begin teaching this basic insight, which he called the Four Noble Truths. Truth number one, suffering exists everywhere. Truth number two, the cause of suffering is attachment. Truth number three, it is possible to end suffering. And truth number four, the means to this end is the Eightfold Path. Now, what the Eightfold Path asks of us is the topic for another sermon. But what the Eightfold Path is pertains to today's talk. And if we look at these Four Noble Truths and the Eightfold Path through the lens of brain function, what Buddha taught is simply limbic system training, mammalian brain reprogramming. In short, it's an operating system upgrade. The Buddha realized that when we learn to retrain the emotional trigger and response systems, we actually reprogram our mammalian brain, which then profoundly changes the way we react to what life throws at us, and therefore changes our experience of suffering. He realized it's not possible to get rid of the physically hardwired systems, but through direct experience, he proved to himself that it is possible to change how we feel and react to what happens. He saw that the solution to suffering was to retrain the brain, to reprogram the way in which we react, and in that way, change how this ancient human hardware functions. The same old primitive triggers are still there. The same old nervous system wiring is still there. However, the call to action that comes from that old brain is changed into something new. The tool that the Buddha offered for this retraining is meditation. Call it mindfulness, call it contemplative prayer, call it meditation, call it getting in the zone. A rose by near the name would smell sweet. The words to describe the state do not matter. The form to use does not matter. The only thing that matters is the internal experience you have. And so here it comes. The sales pitch. You knew it was coming, didn't you? I'm about to sell you on why you should meditate. So, good morning, friends. I'm here to share with you a most amazing offer, perhaps the most amazing offer you personally have ever encountered. Now, don't misunderstand me. I'm not here to take your money because, well, I already did that during your offertory. I'm not here to sell you anything. The bird seed was free. You could pay for the wrapper if you want. The seed's free. And I'm going to tell you, this is the most amazing technique you'll ever, ever have the chance to try. Oh, did I mention that this remarkable process cures arthritis, bursitis, rheumatism, muscular soreness, baldness, and back pain? My friends, that's not all. This takes care of dandruff, poor motivation, low self-esteem, a sagging SAT score, and bad gas mileage. Well, maybe not that last one, but once you've tried this one-size-fits-all, cure-all, surefire fix-all for whatever ails you, you will wonder how you ever got along without it. Now, friends, you might still be wondering, where can I buy me some of this? And I'm sorry to tell you, this technique is not for sale at any price. But for a limited time only, you, my nearest and dearest friends, could, if you wanted to, test drive this for free. Try it for yourself. See what happens. Don't take my word for it. If you're not completely satisfied with the results, simply return your unused meditation time for a full and complete refund. In fact, I'll double your money back for any of it that you're not interested in using anymore. Now you might be thinking, this sounds too good to be true. And actually, I'd love to let you in on a secret if it really is too good to be true or not, but the union of amalgamated hucksters, hipsters, hypsters, pitchmen, and zealots prevents me from disclosing any of the fine print. That's because there actually isn't any fine print. It's really, really very simple. Sunryu Suzuki Roshi gave it away when someone asked him, "What should I do?" And he said, Shikantanza, only just sit. One simple instruction, three little words, and you will be changed forever. And the world will change forever. So how is it possible that only just sit is so worthwhile? It seems to me that to make everything in that crazy quilt of a brain work better together, it happens when you only just sit. If you sit for 20 minutes in silence and do it daily for about a month, you will have developed an ability which is more or less the equivalent of rebooting your computer. And it has similar results. More memory, less confusion, fewer programs left running in the background, more processor capacity. The programs you run will run faster. Your system doesn't crash anymore. It becomes unlikely you'll get stuck in sadness for very long, or that you'll fly into a rage over spilled coffee. So this sounds pretty good. So what is it that actually happens when you sit down to meditate? What's the experience like? How many of you have ever tried this once?
Me too.
How many walked away from that experience thinking, I can't do this? Yeah, me too. Yeah, I started and stopped many, many times over the years. And what I learned is that meditation is like physical exercise. Everyone can exercise, but not all of us can do the same level of exercise because we're not all in the same shape. You might be able to do 100 sit-ups. Me, I'm glad if I can manage 3. I go to the Y and they tell me to do Zumba. I go to see a physical trainer and he tells me to do burpees. I talk with my friend who says Pilates is the answer. Who do I believe? What do I do? So the single most important thing in any exercise program, you know what it is? Pick the program that you'll do. Because if you don't show up, none of it matters. It's also helpful to have someone who can explain what to expect in terms of your progress. How it should feel while you exercise, and how you feel afterwards if it was done correctly. Meditation is exercise for parts of your brain. All the same rules apply. Everyone can exercise. Everyone can meditate. Find someone to help you get started. And once you've established a decent routine, then and only then slowly work up to longer and more challenging meditations. When you first meditate, when you hear those instructions, settle into your seat, relax, just be. Sounds easy enough, right? How hard could that be? How hard is it to feed birds? It's not that hard. Well, unless you want to put some bird seed in your hand and wait for them to show up. When you sit and try to stop thinking, your mammalian brain still wants to do something. It wants to start thinking again about something, about anything. Maybe you notice noises in the room and how they bother you, or you remember that you need to put bread on a shopping list. This experience is called monkey mind, or wild horses, or a froggy nature. It's wild birds who won't do what you've invited them to do. Regardless of the description, the experience is the same. The mind refuses to quiet. You try again. It starts up again. You try really hard. You try really, really hard. You force the quiet. And it does for a little bit until you can't force it anymore. And what happens next? Now, if you're like me, you get frustrated with meditating and try even harder with no better results. No matter how hard I tried to make those darn birds eat from my hand, they wouldn't. And at times I got to where I started to feel as if I don't care about these stupid birds anymore. All right, let them go find their own feet. I'm tired of this. I'm going back inside. I'm going to watch something on the Nature Channel. I can see birds up close anytime if I want to. They don't have to be up here. And so when the meditation period is over, what's my takeaway? What's my understanding about myself? Well, I proved to myself yet again that I can't do it. I still can't do it. It doesn't work for me. Everybody else seems to be silent and quiet and calm. And inside me, it was a nut house filled with wild birds chased by noisy monkeys trying to get out of the way of all the wild horses. So what if I told you that what you're really doing during those first meditation sessions is the equivalent of pushing the test button on your smoke detector? The systems check on your reptilian and mammalian brain turned out A-OK. The first law of human being is, thou shalt not disrupt the flow of data or suffer the consequences. Anxiousness, fidgeting, itchiness, irritability, frustration, uncontrolled thinking about everything and anything, an overwhelming need to check your watch, an irresistible urge to think about the laundry at home, it doesn't matter. When deprived of data, these ancient systems substitute internally generated data to fill the gap. This internally generated data gets substituted for the missing external information, and those older parts of our brain are happy again. They don't care about where the data comes from as long as they have something to do. This life and death desire to keep the data flowing and process it by assigning judgments and interpretations, it only proves that you have survivor genes and you prefer to be vigilant rather than be lunch. We are hardwired to continuously feel and judge and try to make sense of what we observe. This is not failure, this is success. This is why we still exist as a species. This is the reptilian and mammalian brain doing what they do best, keeping us alive. Now, meditation throws a wrench into this always-on recognition and judgment system. What's so interesting is that by developing this seemingly unnatural ability to do nothing with the most advanced data collection, pattern recognition system on the planet, you actually provide an opportunity for your neocortex to finish the unfinished thinking you've dragged around inside your head, maybe for quite a while. The thoughts you began but didn't finish because you ran out of time or got distracted by the next alarm bell of the fight and flight system going off. In any case, in any way, we are time travelers, spending time everywhere but here and now, which seems to race past us at mammalian brain processing speeds, while we're still slogging along in our thinking at those neocortex speeds, about one-tenth as fast. This train of confused, jumbled thoughts is normal, natural, and entirely expected. The runaway train of thinking happens to everyone at first. Be patient. In time, you'll catch up to yourself. In time, that train will slow down. The monkeys will get tired. The frogs will chill out. And suddenly, you'll accidentally realize you've been sitting for quite a while with birds eating out of your hand. Not thinking, not doing, just being. The initial experiences of meditation are very different from the experiences you have later on. In the beginning, I suffered through meditation sessions hoping I wasn't too disruptive to others in the group who all seemed to be blissed out and fully enjoying the meditation experience while I could barely hold it together. I was distracted 99% of the time. My thighs felt stiff, my butt was sore, my left ankle hurt, my right leg kept falling asleep, my back ached no matter how I fidgeted, and fidgeting embarrassed me because I had been told to sit still, perfectly still, and do not move. For me, meditation started as torture. There were times I felt as though I'd explode if I didn't move something, anything, just even one millimeter. But in time, as I continued to struggle with the physical demands of meditation, my time on the cushion was completely absorbed with thinking about leg pain and stiff knees and back pain and crazy itchy nose all of a sudden. And it's no wonder that I found endless excuses to avoid meditating. Eventually, that physical discomfort happened less and less. Sometimes I'd have a whole 5 minutes at the beginning of a sit where nothing hurt and nothing itched and nothing cramped up. And these were the times when I found myself wondering, what should I be doing instead of counting down the minutes till the bell rings again and the sit is over? I had started thinking about thinking instead of thinking about uncomfortable body sensations. I was making progress. So these few silent moments were the times when I started to get to know myself on the inside just a little bit. These were the opportunities to notice that I was thinking, what I was thinking about, and what I could do about it. This is actually the first of three phases of meditation, the focusing process, developing skill to become single-minded without distraction, to learn to sit without moving, to learn to sit with no thinking. Once this focusing skill is developed, where you can sit uninterrupted for some time, maybe 10 or 20 minutes, phase two naturally begins. Phase two is letting go and defocusing. You stop focusing and you just be. It's kind of like when the pilot turns off the seatbelt light in the airplane and you realize you're free to move about the cabin, but you have no need to go anywhere or do anything. You notice everything without judgment or interpretation. You just observe. You're free. So just notice the candle. Just notice the incense. Just notice the ticking of the clock. There's no values assignment to any of this. The sound of the truck brakes outside are not bad. The incense smoke is not good. The person sitting next to you is not distracting. You're just present. Everything is only and just present. There is no anticipation of what happens next. This is the Sound of Silence. This is Samadhi. This is the direct experience of the Buddha nature. So congratulations. You've arrived. You're now strong enough to begin your workout. The initial pain and discomfort, the endless distractions, the seemingly fruitless efforts, they've all finally paid off and gotten you to where you're able to sit in internal silence, experiencing this non-judgmental observation for an extended period of time. This is where the third and final phase of meditation can happen. When you drop into this non-judgmental stillness and silence often enough, there will come a time where, for no apparent reason, you experience a state of deep contentment. Some call it bliss, or kensho, or satori, a state of unreasonable joy. This is the crack in your cosmic egg. These experiences change how your brain relates to itself, and it changes in a very good way. This is why you're here. This is not something to plan for, but something to plan on. If it happens, when it happens, it's typically unexpected. It's an accident of sorts. Ken Wilber claims enlightenment is an accident, and meditation makes you more accident-prone. So you need the patience to stick with meditation past the beginning where nothing changes and nothing seems to happen. You need the kindness to be able to tell yourself, enough for today, let's continue again tomorrow. You need the compassion to come, yet again come, as many times as it takes. Given enough time, you will learn to ride the horse instead of letting the horse ride you. Your froggy nature will stop jumping and sit still. Your monkey mind will stop chattering and slide gently into silence. The wild birds that were afraid of you will be eating out of your hand. If only you could teach your brain to become still enough. And so in closing, I have an interesting but unproven factoid. I actually think it takes less time to learn to meditate than it does to get chickadees to eat out of your hand. So if you'd like help with chickadees, I don't know where to send you. But if you'd like help with meditation, come join the Zen Studies group that meets on Thursday nights at 6:30 here in the sanctuary. First timers show up at 6 to get oriented. If you decide to drop in, bring your doubts, confusions, failures, and questions, and you can leave your bird seat at home.